We're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to bring Michelle up to talk about basically how place matters and how racial segregation impacts health. So Michelle is completed her PhD in public health policy in 2011, and she will graduate with her MD in May of 2013. Her academic and clinical focus is on maternal child health and reproductive justice. Help me in welcoming Michelle.
All right. Good morning, almost afternoon. Thanks for your attention. If I weren't so crowded in here, I'd ask you guys for a seventh inning stretch or something.
I feel bad for you guys in the back.
There's, kind of in the hallway. There's space up here.
There's space up front if you want to kind of pull it in a little bit. You can sit in the aisle, you know.
Yep.
If we have a fire drill, we'll just trample you. Thank you.
I'll give you guys a couple minutes to get settled. In the meantime, I'd like to thank my co-author, who's also my dissertation advisor and committee chair, Paula M. Lance. I'll be speaking to you today, as mentioned, about racial residential segregation and its association with the incidence of low birth weight among communities of women of color. All right, so I'm going to start off my presentation with a slide that probably many of you have seen in lots of other contexts, but I always like to try to give a little bit of background. So low birth weight inequities are a particularly important and salient public health issue. There's an increased morbidity, mortality, and increased social, emotional, and economic costs associated with low birth weight. As many of you may know, low birth weight is a large driver of infant mortality, particularly among communities of color. Low birth weight affects 6 to 7% of all pregnancies in the United States, but it actually affects 12 to 14% of African American pregnancies, according to some recent studies. But it's also, importantly, the leading cause of death for African American and Hispanic infants. Among white infants, congenital anomalies are actually the leading cause of infant mortality in the first year, followed by the sequelae of low birth weight. But for families of color, the leading cause of death for infants in the first year is a sequelae of low birth weight. Race among Hispanic women of low birth weight differ actually by country of origin, and I'd like to put a caveat out there that unfortunately, because of the way my sample is, or the population that I studied is sort of derived from the birth certificates, I couldn't do a lot of work to separate women of different Hispanic origins, so apologize for that, but just know that in other studies there has been shown to be a difference in the outcomes for women of different origins, as well as of immigration status, so foreign-born versus U.S.-born. Importantly, individual risk factors, that is, the things that moms do when they're pregnant and the things that moms face in their individual lives, can't really explain the gaps that we see on a population level in terms of low birth weight outcomes and infant mortality. So even when you control for, say, tobacco use during the prenatal period, you can't explain the entire gap between African American women or other women of color and white women in their rates of low birth weight. For instance, black women have higher rates of low birth weight at each level of income or education than white women of similar levels of education. In fact, in Krieger's paper, she shows that for women, black women who've graduated from some college or above, they still have higher rates of low birth weight than white women who never finished high school. And since individual factors can't really explain these differences, one of the things that I have really become interested in is how our contextual environment may be related to the ways in which our society is culpable for producing these low birth weight inequities. And I'm particularly interested in racial segregation. Sundstrom, who's actually a geography researcher, coined the phrase racialized geography to describe the ways in which in the United States in particular, and in urban areas in particular, physical spaces are characterized by historic economic and political forces that produce segregation. This essentially results in the isolation of racial and ethnic groups from one another and results in their differential access to and exposure to wealth, quality schooling, and it's not simply due, the creation of segregation is not simply due to racial preferences for particular neighborhoods. In fact, when you ask populations about what their ideal neighborhood would be, it's often a fairly diverse neighborhood, with the general exception of white folks. And so that being said, discrimination is still an important driving factor, whether you see that on the institutional or the individual level. Discrimination is still an important driving factor in the creation of segregated neighborhoods in this country. Segregation, therefore, constrains opportunities and choices, and it constrains particularly opportunities and choices for health outcomes, and it alters individuals' perceptions of opportunity, which you could argue, depending on who you are, may be protective or detrimental. Another particularly interesting point to bring up is that hypersegregation is a hallmark of black neighborhoods in many cities, which is not just segregation on sort of a low level, but segregation to the point of greater than 60% of the people in the city would have to move in order for the neighborhoods to all be representative of the demographics of the city. So what are some of the potential pathways? There's been a lot of theoretical work on what are some of the potential pathways by which segregation could sort of get under the skin to produce health outcomes. Some of those are through the creation and maintenance of unhealthy behaviors, so smoking or poor nutrition. For instance, there's research to suggest that there are more smoking advertisements and more availability of cigarettes in segregated neighborhoods, which may lead to higher rates of smoking. But I think beyond the sort of creation and maintenance of unhealthy behaviors, we have a lot of other things to think about. Direct toxic environmental exposure, so getting at some of the environmental justice work. Low access to healthcare and or low quality healthcare, getting high quality facilities to locate in segregated neighborhoods can be quite difficult. There's also, in particular, as we've just heard, a huge, I think personally, a huge impact of stress related to the conditions associated with living in segregated areas. And those stressors may be material, such as housing conditions or economic poverty, but not every segregated neighborhood is a poor neighborhood. And I think this is very important to remember. And so some of these other, there can be other social stressors, such as stereotype threat and some of these other things that might occur for women of color in neighborhoods that are segregated. And then, of course, increased potential for experiences of gendered racism, which is yet another stressor. So one of the things that a couple of the questions that I sought to answer, and this is all part of my dissertation. There are many, many questions involved in this work, but I'm going to focus on just two of them. The overarching question was, is segregation measured at the local level related to low birth weight inequities? And in particular, is racial isolation associated with pregnancy outcomes for different racial and ethnic groups? So one of the things I had noticed in the literature is that many times we see articles that are related specifically to African American women and whites, or Hispanic women and foreign-born versus U.S.-born. And so what I had wanted to do was look at a place where I could do a little bit more assessment of women of many different racial and ethnic groups living in somewhat close proximity, even if segregated, somewhat close proximity to each other. And then the other question that I had that will come up in this presentation is this relationship dependent on either intrauterine growth restriction or appropriate for gestational age, early birth? And I think this is a particularly important question because we often, in the public health community, lump all of low birth weight together, but there are actually multiple ways in which low birth weight is produced, the two important ones being intrauterine growth restriction, or also known as small for gestational age. Of course, there are some medical differences between those, but it's really not important to get into them. Essentially, small for gestational age is when a child is born and has not been able to reach its growth potential because of in utero difficulties in growth. So usually these are related to vascular dysfunction or placental dysfunction, so the fetus is not getting enough oxygen or nutrients, and it doesn't reach its full growth potential. In the literature, we typically define this as less than the 10th percentile weight for age. So there are age curves for each gestational age. What is the bell curve? And if you're in the less than the 10th percentile, you're considered small for gestational age. Appropriate for gestational age early birth is typically a function of preterm birth. So these are fetuses that are growing appropriately throughout the pregnancy, and for whatever reason, the pregnancy is truncated early, they're born early, and say they're born at 32 weeks, they're under 2,500 grams, but if the pregnancy had continued to 40 weeks to term, they would have been fine, they would have been normal birth weight at that point. There's been some research to suggest that preterm births are resulting in appropriate for gestational age low birth weight can often be a result of infections, acute stressors, things that happen that cause the body to all of a sudden go into labor too early. Importantly, when I separated these out in my study, obviously there can be some overlap between these two categories, but there's some data to suggest that early births, preterm births, among fetuses that are small for gestational age may actually be driven by the fact that they're small for gestational age, so that the growth restriction actually starts a cascade of events that lead to early term labor. So those fetuses were all, or those babies were all categorized as small for gestational age. I'm sorry, am I not speaking loudly enough? Just a lot of ambient noise, yeah. So in order to parse out some of these questions, I used data from the California Vital Statistics, from the Census 2000, California Vital Statistics data. Basically all of, oh, I'm sorry, this is an old slide. My apologies. Okay, so this is, I used California Vital Statistics data from LA County from 2000 to 2004. So all births in LA County from 2000 to 2004. That had enough address data that I could geocode them to a specific census tract. Notably, there were no major differences in maternal race, age, or birth weight of the infant of birth records that I couldn't put in a tract because they didn't have enough address information. So along with that vital statistics data, I had the weight, gestational age, and sex of the infant, as well as any congenital anomalies. For the mother, I had race, age, education, insurance, parity, prenatal care, and pregnancy comorbidities, all of which were included in the model. Importantly, exclusion criteria for this were any multiple gestation pregnancy was excluded and any pregnancy with congenital anomalies, because congenital anomalies can often drive low birth weight, and I was specifically interested in low birth weight not driven by congenital anomaly. Of the census tract data, the proportions of racial groups in each census tract were used to create the segregation indices. And these were, also, and then I also used the census tract data to create some community levels of education, income, poverty, nativity, language proficiency, and housing stability. We used all of these in hierarchical modeling analyses, which I'm happy to get into more of the methodology of that if people are interested, but it's essentially nested regressions. And so the individuals are placed within their neighborhoods, giving you the opportunity to show what the effect of the neighborhood is independent of individual level characteristics. So this is just a GIS map of the Los Angeles County data. Each of these census tracts is colored based on the proportion of mothers living in that tract of a given race or ethnicity. Only tracts that are 50% or more of one race ethnicity, so all moms, more than 50% of the moms are of the same race or ethnicity, have a color. Any of the white tracts are sort of more integrated or diverse neighborhoods. What you can, what I'll point out is that the sort of outskirts of LA County are heavily populated by white mothers. There's sort of a Pasadena group of Hispanic mothers and then a central LA sort of population of Hispanic mothers. The Inglewood area is largely African American mothers, and then the red areas out on the east side of Los Angeles are Asian and Pacific Islander mothers. The darker the square, the higher the population that is solely that particular race or ethnicity. The other thing I'd like to point out is Los Angeles offers a really nice place to try to tease apart some of the effects of racial segregation versus economics, because there are segregated neighborhoods that span the entire gamut of income. This is a Geddes-Ord spatial clustering Z-score of low birth weight in these neighborhoods. Basically, the Geddes-Ord score, because it's a Z-score, is statistically significant. It basically shows hotspots. And if you're a dark red or a dark blue census tract, that's a hotspot either because it has more than you would expect if low birth weight were randomly distributed or evenly distributed throughout the area, then you would expect that that all of them would have sort of the same amount. Red places have more than you would expect, and blue places have fewer. And it's you can see that the vast majority of hotspots are concentrated around the Inglewood area. This is just to point out that, again, there are many segregated communities within Los Angeles County that have both some poverty and lower poverty. All right, so to get to the meat of it, the multi-level LOGIT model results. For African-American women, racial isolation from whites was associated with increased, I should mention, all of these models were stratified in order to avoid cross-interpreting really annoying cross-level interactions, because there's actually a lot of controversy in the multi-level community about how you should interpret those. So these are stratified by race and ethnicity. So in the models for African-American women or women who identify as black, racial isolation from whites was associated with increased low birth weight, specifically small for gestational age birth, and the adjusted odds ratio for low birth weight was 1.12 or 1.13, so 13% increase. And the adjusted odds ratio, let's try that again, for small for gestational age birth as compared to appropriate for gestational age or normal weight was 1.16, so about a 16.5% increase in small for gestational age birth from living in a segregated neighborhood. These are all adjusted for those individual covariates we had talked about at the beginning, as well as neighborhood economics and other neighborhood characteristics like women's disadvantage, residential stability, and level of immigrant neighborhood. For Hispanic women, there is actually, in my opinion, a surprising similarity to Blacks in terms of their outcomes when you look at isolation from whites, especially for U.S.-born Hispanic women. So racial isolation from whites was associated with increased low birth weight of odds ratio of 1.12, but it was not driven by a specific etiology. So that didn't seem to be a discrimination between appropriate or small for gestational age. The reason I found this a little bit surprising, there's been a lot of research about this so-called ethnic enclave effect, that for some women living in a racially separated neighborhood can be protective, given, especially for foreign-born women, if they don't speak the language, it can be a social buffer. For Asian and Pacific Islanders, there may be some evidence to actually support this ethnic enclave idea, in that racial isolation from Hispanics, and this is kind of an interesting piece of the data, racial isolation from whites had no effect for women who identified as API, but from Hispanics predicted decreased odds of low birth weight with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.85, and this actually operates through decreased stress of appropriate for gestational age, so suggesting kind of more of an acute stress picture. So quickly through some of the conclusions, racial residential segregation in a multi-ethnic city is very complex, and the associations between segregation and birth outcomes actually do vary by racial group and identity, or nativity. And the economic factors, in fact, in my models, economic factors had no impact once you included segregation. Can it explain these disparities predicted by residents in segregated neighborhoods? The data that I have can't show it, but I would hypothesize that there's elements of stress, and then when you look at the data for the Hispanic women, you could ask yourself about residential choice. Maybe the ethnic enclave effect has something to do with being able to choose to live in an ethnically separated neighborhood as opposed to not being able to have that choice. And we may be seeing a transition in LA County. Obviously, this is cross-sectional, so I have to theorize. Maybe seeing a transition in LA County from women of Hispanic origin choosing neighborhoods of largely Hispanic makeup and then being sort of confined to those neighborhoods thereafter, and the question of opportunity. I think in terms of health policy, this helps us to say that we need to understand the context of women's lives, where they're living, and it also shows us that spatial data can give us some indication of where our areas of highest risk are and where we need to place our resources and attempts at improving some of these outcomes. And with that, I will stop. My apologies for going over.
There's a sign-in sheet going around the room. Please sign that if you haven't yet, and we'll do 5 minutes for questions for Michelle. And I just have to say, it's so painful being a moderator because I don't want to stop you because you're doing such a good job. All right, so for Michelle. Question.
Yeah.
Hi, I have a quick question about the stratified models. Were they all being compared to non-Hispanic whites, or each stratified model being compared to, it looks like maybe the Hispanic race compared to first generation and second generation?
So that's a good question. So the stratified models were, so all African-American women, or all women who identified as Black, all women who identified as Hispanic, all women who identified as Asian Pacific Islander in their own models. The racial segregation indices were, my family. The racial segregation indices were actually divided by isolation from each of the other groups. So there was a Black-white isolation factor, a Black-Hispanic isolation factor, a Black-API isolation factor. And I was only presenting the sort of significant results, but it does get a little confusing. So. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Actually, for Hispanic women, being separated from Blacks was somewhat detrimental depending on the model that you look at. And so I think it's actually a little bit more complicated in the sense that it depends on which group you're separated from and why you're separated from them. It's hard to say with just sort of these very large population sort of 30,000 foot view exactly what's going on, but there's been some folks who argue that in LA County, at least, Hispanic families, as they get more social mobility, are moving actually into middle income black neighborhoods. And so you could make an argument that if that's the case, then separation of Hispanics from blacks could be seen as detrimental because it indicates a lack of social mobility in that direction.
You use this phrase isolation.
Yep.
And I'm not familiar with that as far as from the racial segregation literature. And why did you choose that and how did you?
Another good question. So I actually used a number of different segregation indices. The isolation index was developed by Crevo et al. And it's a census. It's a specific census tract measure. So I'm not measuring segregation of the city. I'm actually measuring the segregation of a census tract in comparison to the census tracts around it. I believe Crevo's measure was published in the early 2000s. I also used Wong's diversity measure. I wanted to compare different ways of measuring segregation at the census tract level. It turns out that Wong's diversity measure is not particularly reliable in a multi-ethnic setting where you can actually end up getting diversity just from having Hispanics and blacks in the same neighborhood and not having any whites or API identified folks in that same neighborhood. And so it falsely inflates what I would consider to be a diverse neighborhood in a multi-ethnic situation. So it's the results of it were somewhat unreliable, and it wasn't very clear to me exactly what information I was getting from it. So that's why I chose to go with the isolation index. I also think there's something important about the separation of groups one from another, and especially when you consider in the U.S. the privileged position of whites, separation from whites is particularly salient in terms of segregation, in terms of the opportunity structure associated with that. My apologies. Okay, so you actually want the calculation. So the statistical... The general idea is the proportion of the... target group versus in the tract of interest compared to the proportion of the target group in tracts surrounding compared to the overall demographics of the city.
So it's like a location quotient.
Similar. Yeah, I'm happy to talk to you more about the details if you're interested. Yeah.
Jack.
Fantastic session. Thank you, everyone, for this.
I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. We just organized. They did, all the work, obviously.
I have a question about time. It seems like we typically think about what's happening today or in the last few decades. And I'm wondering if your model or if you know too well speculate across generations, the great thing with those who spots like the amniotic years, or decades, or even
Sure, absolutely. I think that's an excellent question. It's something that I'm hoping to do with my next project, which is because I have multiple years of data from California's birth certificates. Now that the 2010 census is out, I may be able to actually look at change in neighborhoods from 2000 to 2010. It's actually a very dynamic period for Los Angeles County, and I may be able to actually answer that question a little bit better. Of course, with any of these data, one of the limitations is that there's no way of knowing from the birth certificate the temporal relationship between the mom's residence and, sort of she could have moved there 5 days before the birth of the child, and she would claim that as her neighborhood. So I can't quite get there, but I can at least give some idea about neighborhood change versus risk.
So just one more question kind of for anybody in the group, Michelle or others?
Yeah, we touched on this a little bit, but just thinking about how living, how violence really plays a role in the stress level, and I'm just wondering, are there ways to incorporate that? I don't know about Quebec, but I know in Toronto there's a lot of Latino violence, and, that correlates with low-income communities, so I'm just wondering, will you incorporate that at all with the level of stress in the built environment?
Yes, in that study, we
speak loudly.
In that study, which is going on environment, they have this data on the level of crime in each neighborhood, and they will look at that. I don't have the results right by now. If you allow me, I can say that we just got a grant to do an international collaborative study in which this same analysis will be done also for five other cohorts, one in Sweden, one in Holland, in Rotterdam, one in UK, another one for the Canadian, for the old Canadian population, and also with the U.S. data, with the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, using those children who have been followed up from birth to 10 years old. So this will provide us with much more firm results with larger samples.